This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Well, at first, the first thing I could see was the value of disruption. So, I mean, now people talk about me as a bridge builder, and I don't know whether to be offended or not, and talk about how many ways I network and bring healing people together. But my first talent was just disruption. I mean, especially when 99% of what society is doing is wrong, disruptive becomes a great service to the potential of evolution. And just rattling the cages of those that have locked themselves up in preconception.
And rattling our own cage, our little padded cell of a studio in the sweet madness of Sebastopol, California. Welcome to Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, and this is a show about journeys.
Journeys, well, so a journey has a from and a to, and usually on one end or the other of that, sometimes on both ends, there's home, from home, to home. So what, my friends, is home?
Two stories today, and then a funny little collection of lots of voices. From home to home, I just got home. I was away for 2 weeks, in Europe, as a matter of fact. And then getting back home from that other home where our daughter lives, I think what really placed me there was getting down on my hands and knees in the front yard, and even though what I was doing was sticking my hands in the dirt and pulling up crabgrass... What a suburban thing to do. But I hate it. I'd rather have the nice other weeds. And that was grounding.
And holding on to each other pretty tight.
Oh, putting the arms around, yeah. And arms around and getting in the dirt, that's what this next story is about.
This is Jesse Wolf Hardin.
The mountain is more difficult than the valley. Yet, upon reaching the top, the flowers seem more colorful. More alive.
Jesse Wolf Hardin has lived in the wilderness of southern New Mexico for 20-odd years, where he hosts spiritual retreats. He's a musician, he's written and done art for many publications. He talked with us about his vision of the natural world and how he came to it.
Well, what we're doing now is a Gaian ministry that represents the will and intent of the living earth, as spoken through many different nature traditions, political movements. It's the ultimate resistance of all, is the earth resisting suppression and repression, resisting the loss of her precious voice, and coming to that through a long process, you know, church schools, military schools, runaway, sleeping underneath bridges, anti-war activists, and coming around to realizing that there was absolutely no political or personal or societal dis-ease that didn't have at its roots our essential imagined separation from the living world of which we are a part, constituents of, inseparable. And once we had that separative perception, we could imagine that we're different from other life forms, that there's a hierarchy, that some things are lower, that we're in charge, that certain plants are weeds, and it went on and on. So everything from child beating to failed relationships to the destruction of the last 2% of old-growth forests is rooted deeply in this imagined schism, which is totally non-existent in reality. I would say the career began as soon as I was aware of myself, which is probably about age 2, which meant that I was speaking truths that made my mother's friends mad at her. And I owned it by the time I ran away from military school. Military was a long series of trying to find an educational process that would satisfy me. They weren't punishing me. And although military is really weird, it did allow you to distinguish yourself at a very young age. And of course, they laid all the, you know, can't feel your emotions, shouldn't be expressing real pain or real anguish, and you should snicker instead of guffaw out loud in order to be more adult and more manly. So there was all that weird stuff and hierarchy. But on top of it was these European teachers whose sole job was to help you fan the flames of your own distinction. And of course, little did they know that would lead me to you know, pretend, hiding blankets under, you know, stuffing my blankets and sneaking out at night to find out what girls were like a year later. But my real education came from leaving, from being a runaway, from being pursued by the authorities, from being thrust into a situation where I don't have food to eat, where I have to find out what's real, trust my intuition, trust the tingles. Well, for the longest time, I was satisfied in the school because, like I said, I was getting strokes. I won every ribbon available except for good conduct, which for some reason I just couldn't quite pull off. I even had neatness, but I just couldn't swing the good conduct. But by the time I had been given all these rewards, I was starting to realize the degree, the inequity of being assigned a superior position because of what I knew. When it came time for the spelling bee, only one person was allowed to get a special dessert each week for having won the spelling bee. Not only goes just so long before every other kid hates you and distinction is no longer as pleasurable. I won the spelling bee so many times, I just cut up the white cake into these little tiny slivers that looked like matches with little white sticky frosting heads and passed it around to everybody there so that we could at least share in the glory of what it, you know, of accomplishment. And so here we are marching in line. We're little bitty kids telling each other, hey, line up, man, you know, right face, man, forward march, man. And we'd be marching down. And I got the smart idea to get the job as the guide on, which is the guy at the very end that makes sure everybody else was staying in line and staying in step. And there was only one large tree in this whole field in the back of this walled-in military school backyard field. And when they would go by this tree, I would just step off and climb up the tree real quick. And they would march back and forth for an hour without realizing I was gone. And I would slip back down and get back in line at the last. And that was the beginning of the end of all belief in the lie. I mean, all willingness to accept any aspect of it whatsoever. Because from the top of that giant avocado tree, I could see on one side little boys that were not having any fun. You know, walking in a straight line, rigid, trying to compete with each other and tell each other what to do and prove their worth so that their mother won't stick their long fingernails in them when it's dress parade day and they don't get any awards like I did. And on the other side of this concrete wall, looking over the other side from the branches, is one of the last undeveloped lots. And it's bumpy. It's not been flattened yet. It's just like character. You know, it's still got character. It's got peaks and valleys and experiences. And there's brush hasn't been cleared, so there's places where kids can hide and crawl around on their knees and not be seen by adults and explore themselves without any adult supervision or judgment from society. A place where they can be wild. And wild kids aren't mean kids. They're kids that cry when they're hurting and laugh anytime they're not. They're kids that taste their muffins, that live their life, that are willing to risk grass stains on their knees in order to get down and crawl through the opening into Oz. And it was so obvious of which side of the wall I belonged on. In fact, I think I spent the rest of my life trying to knock walls over and plant trees that allow us to see the other side. Well, I ended up with Outlaws primarily because it was as a runaway that nobody else would have me. I knew immediately that it was a spiritual quest. So whether I was sleeping underneath the bridge, freezing my butt off, I was still engaging a world that was more real and vital and vividly lived than anything in the suburbs of consciousness, in the suburbs of the cities where everything's kind of mitigated and compromised, comfort zone. I threw away the comfort zone for a re-immersion in the experience of what it meant to be alive. So it was only bikers and outlaws and anti-war protesters and fabulous felons that would take me in. That became my family. So maybe bikers were crude in some way, sexist, whatever, but they taught me about tribe, fidelity, loyalty, doing what you're going to say, standing up and fighting for what you believe in. The anti-war protesters sometimes got too political and didn't enjoy life enough, but they taught me that to really have a truth, one has to live it and take risks for it, to take chances even on being arrested, but at least take a chance on losing a few days' work in order to do what's necessary to bring life back to a system of death. And so, I mean, so phase one was getting all I could out of school, which really amounted to just the reward for distinction. And then phase two was to be re-immersed into the real human world where people are drug addicts or they're suffering or they're hurting or they're impoverished or they're fighting back or they're sleeping in the park underneath newspapers, where the intensity of what it means to be alive and the integrity necessary to live that life became the phase two of the education. Phase three was realizing that everything that I thought I knew during that time and everything I read was secondary to the actual experience of direct inspiration from the natural world that has informed every activist, witch, druid, magician, ass-kicking Luddite that's ever existed on this planet. My first real lengthy time in nature was after this series of anti-war activism and getting in trouble and riding around on motorcycle all over the United States. It came at the moment when I realized that I had to be somewhere. I could no longer just be. I had to be somewhere. And place became a component of wisdom. It didn't come from drifting and knowing lots of beautiful places. Just like knowing lots of beautiful women, you can't touch them all at once. There's a point where you got to get it down to, at least for the moment, those that you could actually throw a leg over and touch with one finger. And I mean, my first move to the wilderness, that was just a few years before. I moved to the Pecos wilderness with the first wild-ass half-Cherokee, half-Irish woman I could find with a knife on her side. And we took off to make life more real. That's all we knew we were doing. And came out to New Mexico, the place where I'd been born but had never seen, you know, as a conscious being. And coming back to it was a re-immersion in a depth of enchantment that I'd never known. It was beyond any drug experience, beyond any fantasy. I felt like I was coming back to a place that I had walked forever and was meant to walk forever. I came through the Gila the first time and knew I was meant to be there. And I couldn't figure out how to make a living there. I really never have figured out how to make a living there. But I was so intimidated by it, and I had a pregnant woman by that time. So we came back a little closer to civilization near Santa Fe, and I caretaked a wildlife refuge for 2 years. In that time, I funneled enough spirit from the earth to create an artistic body that led to an actual opening of a gallery in Taos dedicated to the metaphysical and to environmental consciousness called Mountain Unique. And I never lost that necessity to return to the Gila itself, a place where I was, it wasn't just my salvation, but a place that was my assignment and my calling. But I came here about 26 years old, closed the gallery, right, which was not only making me a living, but giving a lot of spiritual and ego satisfaction to be doing something wonderful and being paid for it. I closed it up and moved it to a place where everybody thought my artwork was crazy hippie nonsense, full of, you know, what few people are there are cowboys and reactionaries, wondering why I'm being called to somewhere, jerked off the road, maybe the end of my communication with the rest of humanity, my ability to teach and help, moving there. But it turned out to be just the opposite. By surrendering that all, by giving up the gallery, the income, I mean, I literally sold the engine out of the school bus. And the idea of selling the engine out of my precious bus meant I was landlocked. And years later, I was reading about Viking warfare, where they would sometimes sail into a particular bay to rob some pretentious English abbey, and they'd find themselves surrounded by far more of the enemy than they anticipated. And rather than just roll over and play dead or get back on their ships and bail, often the chieftains would set fire to the dragon ships with the obvious intention that there would be no half-hearted swings. 23 years ago, the commitment that if I had to be totally alone, no matter what job I had to do, no matter what the cost was, that I was given wholly to an entire planet through the touch and the sensation and the aperture of a particular loving place. Sweet Medicine Sanctuary is an in-holding in this huge national forest. Only 2% of the private land in the largest county in the state of New Mexico, only 2% of it is private. If you look on a national forest map, one of those itty-bitty white specks on that big green map is the county seat with a total of 400 people in it. Some miles down the river from that, and seven crossings down that river from the nearest road, sits an 80-acre inholding, the tiniest little speck. And yet once you're there, its scale is unending. It's as if we're standing in the very center of the universe. And so as you're driving out of the valley, you're leaving the desert behind. There's still blossoming cactus, but suddenly there's pinon and juniper and 100-foot ponderosas and giant old-growth cottonwoods with gnarly bark that you can fit your whole hand in between the plates. It takes 10 people to reach around to hug. And then the river is the lifeline of anywhere in the Southwest. Even in the high mountains where there's lots of ponderosas, you still have very little green at the lower levels compared to the Northwest or the Northeast. But wherever there's a river, there's life. And it's living and fluid and changing. And sometimes it's a tiny trickle we can jump over, and sometimes it's a raging flood, typical of a wild woman, I'd say. And that river is the lifeblood, not just of the forest, the red willows, the cottonwoods, but it brings green and life and vitality to all the wildlife, to everything that exists there. And it's the place where the spirits hang out to celebrate at these doorways to a more magical way of being. They don't leave, they hang, they clutter, they rub elbows, they make noise, they play drums, they sing to remind us not only that we're in a place of nature, but a place where previous inhabitants for thousands of years lived a life of respect for that sacred source. And when I got there, there was nothing growing. Anything a cow could eat was gone. Cattle have so little to eat in the Southwest. What they do is hang on the rivers. So the first part of what became a spiritual as well as environmental mission, I didn't understand it at the time. I just thought, well, they're eating the grass, chase them. The first component was to run down there and run with my own little kids and scream and yell with a rusty war sword in the air, chasing these dharmically perfect, admittedly, creatures off this ravaged landscape. I did that for 6 years until the Fish and Wildlife Service noticed so much growth just from that process of intimidating the local cattle that they awarded me a partnership in wildlife grant and paid for a fence around that I never could have afforded. I was barely making the payments. A fence around the entire 80 acres. The next step to that story, though, and this is kind of empowering for everybody to see how one little thing, one investment with no certainty of results can lead to immense opening up of possibilities. And as a result of photographs of that, I mean, looking down down the fence, you have on one side still beautiful, gorgeous canyon, but no grass growing, no small flowers, just a small amount of old growth. On the other side, a stark demarcation from where they'd put up that fence and where I'd been so long protecting the land is a verdant forest, a promiscuous forest of life, recreating life, all these animals endlessly celebrating and being wild and making their noises, and green, solid mass of green. And those photographs of that fence line were used as a show and tell for the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson for lawsuits that they'd engaged in along with Forest Guardians of Santa Fe. The end result being the protection of a corridor of the river that's 30 miles long, the St. Francis, patron of animals, river.
During this process, through his artwork, he came into contact with the founders of Earth First, devoted to radical action in protection of the environment. Traveling about, doing actions, lecturing, but feeling the tension in himself between the travel and being home.
How many times can we speak about love and not be making love? How many times can we speak about place and never be home? So it's been an endless balancing act because there is so much overlap, because it's absolutely no separation between our reconnection with ourself and with the actual dirt and soil of substance, with the real earth, the real planet, the reality. No way to separate them, just a chance that if we dance well enough, if we fall and stand up again enough times, that it'll look like samba. And so I went from being gone, never being gone the first few years that I bought in. In fact, walking all the way to town, earning the rednecks great respect for carrying out a deep cycle battery just so I could hear tunes, you know, recharging it and carrying it on my back all the way back down the river. That was the establishment of rapport with the cowboys. They thought, well, he ain't your average hippie, they said. The journey continues. Very much the same thing, because we're stepping out of a paradigm or a reality that seems locked in place, that seems impervious to our creativity and our art and our beauty and our pleadings and our prayers. It's like sometimes when your awareness increases so much and you find yourself in a Denny's restaurant or something, you know, on a horrible road trip, and everywhere around you, you can't just eat your food. You've got the waitress, and you know she's not really happy and can't wait to get out of work, and she hasn't been listening to her kid lately, and you can see that he feels left out waiting for her to get off work, and some chump has left her and made all this happen, and he's over in the far end booth pretending he's happy when he's not. And this endless, you know, you become bombarded with, as you become an aware empathy, you become bombarded with the sensation and the imbalance as well as the balance of everything that's around you. But that is the same power that can thrust you out of being willing to accept, you know, fake wood grain, fake spirituality, and you require an absolute intensity, a magnification of life and spirit and sex and magic and death that makes everything else seem what it is, something less. I try to expect nothing, since I'm, you know, the goddess readily knocks me on my knees, any assumptions or expectations. My hope and my prayer is that humans can evolve back, not forward into something else, you know, some space being, disembodied spirit floating through the universe, but to evolve back into our original purposeful beings, which is as lovers, defenders, and celebrants of a magnificent magical universe. What I fear most is that we won't accomplish that, and then human beings who evolved to be the feelers and the celebrants of the Gaian body, the bards who sing its praises, will die out, and that the earth and spirit will continue manifesting in endless forms without that particular human participation. My prayer is that we will remain a part of the dance. My fear is that we will forget to dance.
We must dance our dance, live our song.
I've never doubted myself, which is why I've been wrong so many times. It's what are you feeling and intuiting, and how can you embody that and act that out? Occasionally that will mean dire mistakes and tragedies and things that you may or may not regret. Other times it will be what the success of your mission and your being depends upon most, is that absolute certainty of action. No holding back, to the hilt, 100%, you know, eat that watermelon all the way down to the rind. That kind of commitment is required for any of this change. I've never not been afraid. Afraid of the oppression that I may not overcome, afraid that I'll try and save a forest grove and then I'll be locked up in the paddy wagon as this has happened while they cut these giant trees in the Calmialpsis and drag them off. Afraid that I have to say the truth and that I'll end up with nobody liking me, because I do. Afraid that the best of what I am isn't good enough, the same human thing that we all go through. It's never been about fearlessness, and perhaps it never is for anybody, really. To fearless means to be unaffected, to be invulnerable, to be impervious. You know, do we want to be impervious? Don't we want to be penetrated, interpenetrated, touched, moved, wounded, celebrated, rewarded? And so fear is not something to get rid of. It's a fuel to use. And just make sure when you put it in the tank, you're heading in the right damn direction. If this may be the last muffin I ever eat, do I dare not taste the blueberry? How dare I?
We were talking with Jesse Wolf Hardin. The music you heard was from Jesse's CD, Oikos, Songs for the Living Earth. You can read more about his books and music on the web at www.lightstreamers.com/jessewolf.htm, or if that's too much, email earthway@concentric.net.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.